The light of early morning illuminated Cassandian's private balcony and the bags under his eyes. He took a sip from his coffee mug and looked at it.
Why is this so sweet?
Because you didn't sleep last night. You need the sugar.
Cassandian frowned at Sean. Orada fidgeted in her seat.
Perhaps a booster?
No.
Orada looked at Resvin. The Chancellor shrugged.
At least some drops for the eyes, just for the optics.
What's wrong with my eyes?
They're bloodshot. Cassandian hadn't slept for almost 48 hours. I knew this because I tracked him. Cassandian had paced a few times during the night because it helped him think. And Gertrude Hunt woke both Sean and me up every time he moved too much. Cassandian held out his hand. Arata jumped up, put a small vial into his fingers, and went back to her seat. The Sovereign put two drops into each eye and firmly set the vial on the table. Resvin approached, picked up a dish with one of Oro's beautiful muffins on it, and held it out to Cassandian as if he were a two-year-old.
Please take a bite, Leiteiro.
Cassandian just looked at him. Miralet looked at Cassandian.
Sleep or food? You must have at least one.
Cassandian picked up a muffin and took a small bite.
Let's move on to the ratings.
Orada looked like she'd bitten into a lemon.
Sorkar is leading across all categories with an average of 17 points.
Of course she is.
It's that damn show.
What show?
Orada tapped her tablet and tilted the holographic screen toward us. On it, a panoramic shot of a battlefield rushed toward the viewer, following a bird of prey that swooped down over the field. Bodies in armor littered the bloody ground. The view zeroed in on a large warrior in antique Dominion armor. He climbed over a hill of the dead to a rock jutting from the bodies. Atop the rock, another fighter splattered with blood roared, brandishing a spear. The challenger made it to the rock and ripped off his damaged breastplate, revealing a shockingly muscular chest. Miralit raised her eyebrows. Two men clashed. They danced across the crag, cutting and slicing. Finally, the challenger leaped and buried his sword in his opponent's throat. The wounded man clasped his neck, spat out a torrent of blood, and stumbled about, waving his arms, seemingly forgetting that there was a blade in his throat. The hero leaped and kicked the pommel of the sword, driving it into the man and knocking him off the cliff. Miraculously, all the soldiers on the field stopped to watch the body fall. The hero pulled off his helmet. He looked remarkably like the Dominion version of Sorkar. If not for the obvious difference in size and pigmentation, they could have been cousins.
I'd watch that.
Cassandian rolled his eyes. The hero grabbed a flag, pulling it from under the corpses, and triumphantly planted it by his feet.
Warriors! Comrades! Look! The tyrant is dead. Let his death serve as a warning to those who dare claim our freedom.
Claim our freedom? It's not even good writing.
They're not watching it for the writing.
No, but they are watching. In huge numbers.
I swear on this field watered with the blood of our battlekin that my blade shall not rest until every threat to our liberty is vanquished. As long as my heart beats in my chest, I will stand for justice and peace.
The camera panned to the few warriors standing among the carnage below.
That's a lot of peas.
Yes, they had a large budget. They even got Samrian for the lead. He's an intellectual, nuanced actor. He usually does mystery and intrigue shows. We talked before the production. He was very apologetic. Apparently, they paid him an obscene amount of money. I don't know what they are feeding him to get him to that size.
Who are they, and when did they have the time to put all this together?
They are the N4E family. They own one of the largest video channels, and they opposed the Leitero succession. They lost, and now they're bitter.
The identities of the spousal candidates were made public 7 months ago. They put it together pretty quick. A tight deadline, but not impossible.
On screen, the hero gripped the flagpole and waved it around, flexing. The message was clear. The Dominion needed a warrior to safeguard its freedoms and lead it to glory. And Cassandian wasn't it.
How do they benefit from Sirkar winning?
They don't. Selecting Sirkar as a spouse would involve the Dominion in the Horde's internal squabbles. He brings very few benefits and lots of problems. Problems which will keep me occupied and distracted. It's one of the many stones they hurl into my path, hoping I will trip on one of them.
I wasn't a Dominion politician, but even I understood that the only way to neutralize Sirkar was to shatter his image as an invincible warrior. And I had no idea how Cassandian could do that. He couldn't exactly order Miralit to march into the arena and kick his ass.
What are the rest of the rankings?
Amphi, Lady Wexen, Bestata, Pryson All, Und, Nikati, Cyanide, Unessa. The show gave Bestata a boost as well. And Und, who was up right after the debate trial, is now down. Also, they really didn't like Cyanide's date. They thought it was boring and she was entitled.
She's a cat.
Resvin nudged the second muffin toward Cassandian. Cassandian broke it in half and bit into it.
Is everything ready for the second trial? Do you need anything?
No, we have it covered.
We did have the arena covered. The rest was up to the candidates. And there was no telling what they would come up with.
Welcome to the second trial! Are you ready? Yeah!
The delegates were indeed ready. We had reshuffled the seating arrangements so everyone sat closer to the stage. Cassandian was back in his section, and we hid his throne mountain under the arena's floor. The door to the portal was shut, and the bridge that connected it to the stage was retracted. The mist was gone, too. I was saving it for the elimination ceremonies. Tony was up above the arena. Today, he would be handling the special effects. Sean parked himself near the Holy Ecclesiarch. Apparently, the elderly man had specifically requested his presence. His Holiness was still pretending to be decrepit. His performance was suffering at the moment, since he and the First Scholar were engaged in a spirited debate, and he was waving his arms with the vigor of a man half his age. Sean looked at me. To everyone else, his expression would be perfectly neutral, but I knew better. This was his long-suffering look. One of Cookie's helpers, a petite merchant with sable fur and bright green eyes, jumped up and down in the observer's section, waving her little paws at me. She could have just requested a call, but she didn't, which meant she wanted to tell me something personally. I extended a narrow bridge to the observer's section, barely a foot wide. A human would have walked very carefully across it. The little Lees scampered over it like it was solid ground. She reached me, dropped a piece of paper into my hand, and dashed back. I retracted the bridge and checked the note, which was written in Caldania's graceful hand.
It is vital that W goes last and the oath right before her. Please indulge me.
I glanced at Caldania. Her grace nodded at me. Now she was passing me notes as if we were in class and she had to hide from the teacher. I surveyed the sections. Sirkar sat in the first row of the Otrakar section wearing a long cloak. Lady Wexen was in her expected place, veiled head to toe in a glittering golden fabric. What was Caldania up to? Well, whatever it was, the order of contestants didn't really matter to me. We could take a break between candidates 5 and 6, and Bestata had to be candidate 6 because Tony had told me her talent required some setup. There was no harm in letting Sirkar go next to last and Lady Wexen after him. If anything weird happened, Sean and I would handle it. I tapped my earpiece. Time to start things up.
Please welcome our first candidate.
I bounced the white light and it stopped under team smiles. A ramp unfurled from the edge of the section to the stage. Amphi rose. She wore a silver dress accented with pale gold flowers that flowed over her body like a glittering stream. A narrow ribbon of hunter green wove through her hair, a nod to Cassandian's outfit during his date with Cyanide. Amphi descended the ramp, crossed the stage, and came to stand in the center. Amphi sang, her voice surging through the music. Behind her, a glowing vine with two shoots, one emerald and the other silver, emerged from the edge of the stage. They wove around each other, spiraling, growing leaves, sprouting buds, branching and twisting as if nourished by her song. Super subtle. The song reached a crescendo. The vine behind her bloomed with golden flowers.
Lovely.
Cassandian's compliment sounded genuine. Maybe with all the conflicts and crises he had to resolve, raising a child with Amphi was beginning to look appealing. She clearly adored him. They were both from the Dominion, and it promised to be uncomplicated. Gaston reappeared to cordially escort Amphi back to her seat. I bounced the light again. Price and Ole was next. He came down dressed in another blue robe, looking humble and handsome.
I've composed a poem to celebrate this once-in-a-lifetime occasion. I humbly offer it to you. The darkness is vast. The universe is cold.
The poem was beautiful, and it spoke of every star being a sun to someone. At the end of it, the Holy Ecclesiarch teared up, and the first scholar rested his wing on his chest over his heart and had to take a moment. Und was next. He performed a dance, and by the end of it, I needed a moment from the sensory overload. Cyanide sang the song of her people, which was long and very yowling. The Higra delegation were overcome and joined in toward the end. Sean's voice came through my earpiece.
I can't take it. It's like a room full of cats being slowly strangled.
Be nice.
She's an expert weaver. Why didn't she make something?
Because she doesn't give away her secrets to the enemy.
My poor werewolf. I could practically feel his eyes twitching. Bouncing the light again was a relief. I settled on Unessa. We needed something to wake us up, and she was unlikely to sing. Somehow I just didn't feel that Dushagoobs put the same value on fine arts as we did. Unessa practically ran down the ramp with a bounce in each step. A portion of the stage, 20 feet across, dropped down in a perfect circle and came back up, carrying a big cage. Inside it, green lizards squirmed and hissed, each about the size of a large house cat. Unessa strode to the cage, pulled a small door near the top open, and snatched a lizard out. The screens around the arena zoomed in on the reptile. It tried to claw at Unessa, but she held it tight by its throat with one hand and pulled its mouth open with the other, revealing long, sharp teeth.
Venomous! Sharp teeth, very fast.
She dropped the lizard back into the cage. A giant screen descended from the ceiling with a digital timer starting at zero. What was she? The numbers on the timer flashed. The cage collapsed and 50 lizards dashed in all directions. Unessa plucked the nearest one off the floor, quick, like a striking snake, and in one smooth motion twisted its head off. Oh, dear universe. Unessa dropped the dead body and snatched the next lizard. She snapped its neck, dropped it, and grabbed another one. Oon's people flailed in alarm, their fins snapping to communicate a predator warning. The Otrakars went silent. They were careful hunters, concerned with preservation and management of the animals whose lives they took, and they never murdered for sport. This atrocity went against every hunting tradition of the Horde. It was just a pointless slaughter, and the lizards were screaming, dashing, and climbing over each other to get away from her.
Stop her!
I dropped the stage around Unessa, leaving her standing on a stone pillar. The surviving lizards scattered through the arena. The Dushagoobs creaked and hissed in outrage.
I warned you.
Gaston sure had. I made my voice do that loud, unsettling whisper thing, sending it to every ear in the arena.
The Sovereign thanks Candidate Unessa Sibate for her demonstration.
A large Dushagoob charged the wall of their section and fell through the floor as Sean sent it back to the pit. The rest of the trees creaked and shook their branches, but stayed in their spots. Unessa counted the lizard bodies with her finger, pointing at each, and looked up at the timer.
12 in 7 seconds.
She smiled. Gaston escorted her back to her seat.
It's time for a short break.
Tables with refreshments sprouted in each section. Cassandian looked angry. I had never seen that before, not when he dealt with Odicus, not even when he found out about Versia's betrayal. Unessa's display of animal cruelty caught him by surprise. I should have asked Gaston to be more specific when he mentioned it, but even if he had, nothing Unessa had done was forbidden under the terms Orada had provided to us. The point of the talent trial was to reveal the abilities of the candidates. It was meant to be a surprise and a display of skill. We all knew what Unessa's special talent was. She had told us during her introduction. She was good at smothering. I gathered the remaining lizards into an enclosure under the arena. The Dushigubs had trained Unessa like a terrier going after rats, except that to them, she didn't even rank as a pet. People felt affection for their pets. Dushigubs felt nothing for Unessa. A sickening feeling washed over me. I had a pretty good idea about what would happen to her if she didn't become the spouse. Tony was moving things around below, creating some kind of obstacle course. The stage was gone. Stone pillars, each just large enough to support a human foot, emerged from the stone tiles, rising to different heights. The shortest was 55 feet tall, the largest 3 feet higher, with a few feet of open ground between them. Tony grouped the pillars into a twisted path. Three platforms appeared, flanking the pillar trail where it curved. Each platform supported a long pole protruding above the trail, with three bags filled with sand attached to the tops of the poles on long ropes.
Ready?
I can't wait.
And we're back. Please give a warm welcome to our next candidate, Lady Bestata of House Mir.
Bestata approached the first pillar, jumped, catching it with her hands, and climbed to the top, standing on 1 foot.
For this demonstration, we will need volunteers.
The entire Otrakar section stood up.
We will only need 3. Please pick among yourselves.
I made bridges from the Otrakar section to the platforms, and 3 Otrakars emerged and took their places.
As Lady Bestata makes her way to the other end of this treacherous path, please do your best to knock her off the pillars and down to the floor of the arena using the sandbags available to you. Only using the sandbags. She must touch the ground for your throw to count. Are you ready, Lady Bestata?
Bestata tied a length of black cloth over her eyes.
Ready.
The crowd anticipated a good show. Cassandian leaned forward, his face showing only interest. No traces of outrage remained. It was still there, he was just hiding it. Bestata unsheathed 2 long, slender swords and leaped onto the next pillar, running across them like they were solid ground. The crowd cheered. She dashed toward the first bend in the pillar path. The Otrakar on the first platform swung his bags in rapid-fire succession as Bestata dodged expertly, holding her swords for balance. The Otrakar on the next platform bet on strategy rather than speed. She spun the first bag, sending it in a circle toward Bestata, grabbed the second bag, aimed it slightly to her right, and let go. The first bag curved, slicing through the air. Somehow, the vampire knight sensed it coming and leaped to a pillar on the side, right in the path of the second bag. The crowd froze. The second bag flew toward her, straight at her chest. Bestata swung her left sword. The black blade whined, priming, and the bag plunged to the bottom of the arena, sliced in half, its sand spilling like victory confetti. Bestata sprinted. The Otrakar swung the third bag, but it was too late. In the observer's section, Karat leaned forward, laser-focused on Bestata, clearly re-evaluating her threat potential. Daggerkun shook his hands and bellowed.
Throw the damn bag! Don't swing it, idiots! Throw it!
The third Otrakar, a lean, powerfully muscled older male, must have heard him. The Otrakar grasped the bag with one hand, leaned back like a javelin thrower, and let it loose. The bag tore through the air and smashed into Bestata just as her right foot touched the next pillar. The bag exploded into a fountain of sand. for a torturous half-second, Bastada teetered on the verge of falling 50 feet to the sand floor below. A drop that far would damage even a vampire in sin armor. Bastada leaped backward, her arms spread like wings, turning her fall into a jump. Her right sword plunged to the ground. She threw her right arm out above her head as she flew, and just as her body began to fall, she caught another pillar with her hand and clung to it. House Mir screamed in triumph, Sirkar's delegation in outrage. The Otrakar on the last platform threw the second bag as Bastada flexed her arm and leaped straight up onto the pillar. The bag smashed against the stone, missing her by a hair. Bastada charged forward, leaping with inhuman grace. The Otrakar snarled, grabbed the rope of the last bag, and jerked it down. The top of the pole snapped. He caught it, ripped the rope from it, tore the bag off, and swung the rope like a lasso. Bastada was almost to the final pillar. Cheater!
Do I stop it?
Huh? No.
Let it play out.
The Otrakar hurled his lasso. Bastada twisted like a dancer on one foot and sliced through the rope with shocking precision. Before the crowd realized what had happened, she jumped to the last pillar and pulled off her blindfold. House Mir surged to their feet, cheering. In the observer section, Karat stood up, raised her hands over her head and clapped. In the Otrakar section, Sorkar clenched his fist and pounded his chair with it. The Otrakar on the last platform screamed, venting his rage. Bastada pointed her sword at him and motioned him forward. He started toward the edge of the platform. Oh, no you don't. I pulled a tendril from the inn, wrapped around his waist, and deposited him back into the Otrakar section. It took another 5 minutes to get the arena back to its previous state and to get everyone to calm down and take their seats. Finally, the stage was back. I stopped the white light under the geheas. Nakati made his way to the stage. He held a string instrument in his hands, something between a lute and a zither. Oh, good. Hopefully this would be elegant and soothing, and everybody would calm down and catch their breath.
I am but a simple student of music. Please forgive me for offending you with my inferior talent today. I was prepared to play one of our classics, an ancient melody that many before me have played with much more skill than I could ever hope. But I have been inspired. I bring a new melody to you today, one that has never been heard before. I dedicate it to Lady Bastada.
Bastada, startled in her seat. Cassandian sat straighter. Nakati paused, holding the instrument in his left hand, his right hovering above the strings, and strummed it. Oh, damn. Song soared in the arena, furious, fast, beautiful, and lethal, like a vampire knight swinging her blade. My cheeks were wet from angry tears. The arena was completely silent, as if all of us conspired to mourn the song's end. Bastada looked shell-shocked. Nakati nodded to her. The Geheas prince turned and went back to his seat.
Amazing! Where else in all the galaxy would we be entertained like this?
I wiped my face with my sleeve. All the emotions from the song still roiled inside me. I wanted to punch something to let the excitement out.
Please welcome our next candidate.
Right. I bounced the white light between the Otrakars and the Temple of Desire and stopped it on the Otrakar section. There you go, as requested, Your Grace. Sorkar stood up and tossed his cloak off his shoulders. The crowd gasped. In the Team Smiles section, Amphi turned plum red. Sorkar wore a southern kilt, boots, and nothing else, just as he had been around the fire talking to Caldania. It wasn't a ceremonial, formal kilt. It wasn't even a casual kilt Otrakar sometimes wore to informal occasions, like dinners with extended family. Nope, this thing was tattered from years of wear. It was also at least 2 inches too short. He had shown up to a black tie event in his inside-the-house sweatpants. I glanced at Dagger Coon.
death!
He covered his face with his hands and swore something harsh and angry into them. Karat reached out and patted his shoulder. Surkar pulled a large, curved knife from the sheath on his kilt. He swung it, flipped it from hand to hand, spinning it over his fingers as if it were attached to him by a magnet, and descended to the stage. I had asked Gaston what Surkar's talent would be, and he said sword dance. Surkar's face didn't read dance. It read murder. Surkar stopped directly in front of us and pointed to Cassandian with his sword.
You! Face me, if you dare, Sovereign!
What?
Prove to me that you're worth my time. Or will you hide behind your throne and your servants like a weakling?
His father was the same. Some people simply must be confronted with the obvious.
Caldania. She had convinced him that he needed to demonstrate his physical superiority in the most obvious way possible, and now he was here, in his kilt, challenging Cassandian, who wasn't even worth dressing up for. Sean growled into my ear.
This is what happens when Caldania talks to people. She better know what she's doing, or I'll wall her in her room until she forgets what the sun looks like.
Well, Sovereign?
My heart hammered in my chest. If Cassandian went down there, there was no way for us to keep him from getting hurt. Caldania knew our inn was on the line. She knew why we were doing this. Why would she put us in jeopardy? Why would she put her nephew into the arena with an Otrakar champion? Was I wrong? Did she want to kill Cassandian? Cassandian stood up. Rezvin carefully, almost reverently, removed the robe from the Sovereign's shoulders. Cassandian wore a black suit underneath. It wasn't armor. It wasn't combat grade. It was just clothes, a form-fitting garment offering no protection at all. Cassandian held out his hand.
Knife.
Miralit stepped forward, produced a knife, and put it into his hand. It was a black, fixed blade with an upswept profile, about 7 inches long, with a simple handle.
I need a path, innkeeper.
I did not want to make him a path. I wanted him to sit his ass down right back on that throne.
Dina.
Fine. I let Gertrude Hunt sprout a narrow ramp curving from our section to the stage below. Cassandian nodded and started down, unhurried and calm. He reached the stage. I left the ramp in place, just in case. The two men squared off. They were the same height, but the Otrakar was at least 50 pounds heavier. His shoulders were broader, his legs were like tree trunks, and when he flicked the short sword, muscles bulged across his huge back. This would end badly. Surkar charged, swinging with his blade in a simple overhead stroke. It was basic, but fueled by his superior strength and guided by years of experience. Cassandian caught his wrist, pulled him forward, moving with the strike, and hammered a kick to the side of Surkar's right knee. Surkar's leg folded, and the power he'd put into his strike drove him to his knees. Cassandian twisted Surkar's arm and dislocated the shoulder with a brutal snap. Surkar's mouth gaped in shock. It wasn't supposed to go like this, and his mind was still catching up to reality. Cassandian drew a thin line across Surkar's neck with his knife, barely nicking the skin, plucked the sword from the Otrakar's weakened fingers, and examined it.
Thank you for this gift, son of Grast and Ulde. I shall keep it as a memento of this meeting.
The Sovereign turned and started toward the ramp. In the observer's section, Caldania beamed, her face ferocious and filled with pride. The arena erupted, electrified. Surkar finally realized that he had been beaten. He looked about, glassy-eyed. I could see it in his face. It didn't just shake him. It shattered his world. Sean?
I got him.
Surkar sank into the floor of the stage, swallowed him, closing over his head, and I felt Sean moving toward the med ward.
Please give a warm welcome to our final candidate.
Gaston didn't even try to address what just happened. Good call. Cassandian took his throne, his expression hard, as if carved from stone. Beating Surkar had given him no joy. It hadn't even vented his anger. Lady Wexen stood up. She walked down the ramp from her section to the stage, swaying gently in tune with a melody. Her golden veil slipped off, flaring behind her like the wings of a beautiful butterfly. She let it fall at the edge of the stage. She wore an amber-colored robe embroidered with golden thread and studded with red gemstones. Her hair was an artful cascade, decorated with a tiara gleaming with gems. Bracelets sheathed her arms. She brushed her right wrist with her fingers, and the bracelets tumbled to the floor onto her veil. She brushed her left, and the rest of the ornaments rained down. She removed the tiara off her head and dropped it onto the golden fabric. Lady Wexen stepped out of her golden slippers and spun across the stage barefoot, her hair flying, her body swaying to the music. Her dress floated around her like a cloud. She moved with an unbelievable beauty, ethereal and at once very human. Her dance fought against everything that was bleak and dark. In the world that was anger and discontent, she was a soothing light, indestructible and powerful like love and hope. It was a gift, and it was meant for only one person. Cassandian sat very still. There were hundreds of beings in the arena, and yet none of us existed. It was only the two of them. It was their moment, and I held my breath so I would not disturb them. As the delegates filed out of the arena, taking the tunnels to their respective quarters, Cassandian leaned toward me.
I've heard my aunt takes frequent walks.
I confirmed that indeed Her Grace enjoyed her daily stroll.
I should like to walk as well. It's good to stretch your legs after so much sitting.
I nodded, stepped away, reached out through the inn, found Caldania, who was on the way to her quarters, and quietly shared Cassandian's newfound love of moderate exercise with her. Now, Cassandian pondered the trees by our pond while I waited a few yards away, watching over him. And Caldania, who had taken an opportunity to change clothes, was moving through the inn toward us. Sean stepped out of the bushes. He was taking the whole traverse through walls thing to a new level. It was honestly easier just to use an established door, but popping out of random places appealed to him for some reason. I held out my hand, and he quietly squeezed it. How's Surkar?
Healing. I sedated him.
Should we worry about him retaliating?
He knows when he's beaten. We talked before he passed out. He's coming to terms with it.
I don't understand why he opened with such a straightforward attack.
I asked him if it ever occurred to him that a person of the Sovereign's status with genetic modification and unlimited resources would have access to the best combat trainers available.
What did he say?
He said why would he need them? He has an army and bodyguards. He doesn't look like a fighter.
The species prejudice tripped him up. The Otrakars are so specialized that you can tell at a glance who's a range fighter and who's a frontline bruiser. Cassandian looks like he'd be a strategist or a tactician at best.
Yes. Surkar judges his opponents by size and what they're wearing. Cassandian doesn't look like a warrior, and Surkar discounted him as a physical threat. In his head, he would crush Cassandian like a gnat. And then the Dominion would love him so much for it, they would force the Sovereign to take him as a spouse.
Doesn't exactly portray Surkar in the best light.
It was dawning on him when I left. If he'd stopped to think about it, that challenge would have never happened, but he hadn't, because Caldania filled his head with fog and nonsense. She never suggested that he challenge Cassandian. She just led him to that door, showed him the shiny world on the other side, and he jumped through it on his own.
A door opened in the distance. Caldania was incoming. Oh, your favorite person is on the way. So scary.
Do you want me to babysit them so you can take a break?
I shook my head. Caldania's more comfortable with me. I have a feeling this will be a difficult meeting. Caldania rounded the bend of the path. She wore a pale, conservative gown that communicated power and maturity without reading old. It was also a style she almost never wore anymore. She looked like the head of state she used to be. The inn chimed, and Sean and I simultaneously paused. The Dushagoobs had decided to pummel the walls of the pit. Sean squeezed my hand again and marched down the path. He'd had just about enough of their acting out, and the Dushagoobs were about to learn the meaning of regret. Caldania and he passed each other on the path, heading in opposite directions. She raised her eyebrows at him and approached me.
He seems rather annoyed.
You permanently damaged Sorkar.
Oh, I did no such thing.
You broke his spirit.
Then he wasn't that strong to begin with. Pain is the best teacher. Whether he learns his lesson is of no interest to me.
Shall we walk, Your Grace? Caldania glanced in Cassandian's direction, took a slightly deeper breath, and slowly started down the path. Her nephew continued to study the trees. Caldania drew even with Cassandian, and as she passed him, he turned and started walking, keeping her pace. I followed a few steps behind. Gertrude Hunt let me know that Resvin and two members of his staff left the inn via the portal. Resvin had been glued to Cassandian since they'd arrived. This was the first time he'd left the inn. Tony was by the portal, probably waiting for the Chancellor's return.
Have you heard of Cease Lathan, Dina?
It was amusing how nobody expected me to do my homework.
I have. Many thousands of years ago, it was a galactic empire. It survived for generations, ruled by a single family, but eventually it fractured in two. One half gave rise to the Seven Star Dominion, and the other to the Six Star Supremacy.
You are well informed. It was a difference of ideology. The Dominion favors a constitutional monarchy with an elected government that shapes its laws, and a royal head of state who presides over the executive branch, while the Supremacy favors...
tyranny. A civilized version of an autocratic government where the ruler's power is absolute in theory and constrained by political considerations in practice.
How does that work with a collective consciousness?
Very well, actually. The ugly truth about democracy is that it breeds anxiety. The responsibility for the government is shifted onto the body of the citizenry, who often lack the awareness and knowledge necessary to make informed decisions. There is no constancy in leadership. The policies vary wildly from one administration to the next, and one never knows where the nation shall be in 10 years' time. It is chaos.
Nice try. Democracy protects the rights of every individual. Tyranny protects only the select few, and not very well.
Tyranny provides stability and rules. Follow the rules, and you will be safe.
At the cost of personal freedoms.
You would be surprised how many beings will gladly trade their freedom for safety.
Not me. This wasn't the first time Caldania and I had clashed over politics. I had seen a lot of the galaxy, and I'd witnessed the kind of horrors a tyrannical government brought. I would take chaos and freedom over stable shackles any day. Yes, it was messy and inefficient at times, but I could vote, I could run for office, I could criticize our government without fear of persecution. And that was priceless. Caldania shrugged.
As paradoxical as it is, authoritarian displays tend to stabilize the public. The citizens find a strong, frightening leader reassuring. The tyrant is a monster, but it is their monster, and they take pride in their power.
To be fair, the Supremacy practices a limited tyranny. The Parliament of the Supremacy is also an elected body. Sometimes they murder incompetent tyrants.
Well, one has to throw the rabble a bone, Dina.
This was the strangest conversation. They were both talking to me without acknowledging the other person existed. I felt Resvin return. He'd brought two people with him. They weren't the same two who'd left. Must have been a team swap. We had given Resvin, Miralit, and Orada a lot of autonomy when it came to their own people, because they changed their staff depending on the situation, and none of us had time to approve every personnel member they brought over. We'd asked them to keep their personal teams to at least 3 members or less.
The ruling families of the Dominion and the Supremacy grew apart over the many centuries, yet each followed a similar method of selecting their rulers. At first, it was calculated marriages and natural birth. Then a ruler with multiple partners and many children, in hopes that one would prove suitable to govern. And finally, genetic modification. A single heir bioengineered to lead the state and its people.
Of which both people in front of me were prime examples.
A century and a half ago, there was a biological attack on the Dominion's ruling family.
Caldania gave him a sharp look.
The perpetrators were found and eliminated, but the damage had been done. A vicious hereditary disease ravaged the bloodline, threatening to permanently end generations of careful genetic selection. It wiped out 3/4 of the family. For 30 years, the ruling family struggled to carve it out of their genetic code, but it came back again and again. It killed the children and destroyed hundreds of embryos in the natural and artificial wombs.
I had never heard of that. It was not in any of the Dominion or Supremacy documents.
The bloodline of the Supremacy carried an immunity to that disease, attained through careful spousal selection and pure chance. The Supremacy benefited from a strong Dominion which served as a buffer between it and the hope-crushing Horde. A secret agreement was reached under the pretense of paying homage to the ancient unity of bloodlines. Caldira Karet Magren, the Empress of the Supremacy, agreed to carry 2 heirs to Sovereign Rebastion to term. To ensure the full transference of immunity, no artificial womb would be used. The embryos would be implanted, 1 at a time, and she would carry her children to term within her body.
Sadness flickered in Cassandian's eyes. There was more to this, somehow.
The creation of an heir is a complex process. The heir is not conceived, but crafted. Whether the gestation takes place within the mother or within an artificial womb, the genetic makeup of the heir is radically different from their siblings. The heir's purpose is to rule.
Made sense?
Raising the heir, providing them with education and guidance, demands full attention from the parents. Even if the heir's parents are in a committed and loving relationship, they delay having more children until the heir is on the cusp of adulthood. And those other children are not heirs, nor will they ever be. If the heir dies, another enhanced embryo carrying the desired set of genes will be created, and in time, a new heir will be born.
It seems like a very lonely childhood.
By design, the heir's first priority is the nation.
Cassandian nodded.
Too much attachment to one's siblings can lead the ruler to make decisions based on emotion rather than logic.
Unfortunately, when you raise a tyrant to exercise their power at will, rules go out the window, even if they're sensible.
Caldira agreed to bear the heirs only if they could be raised together until the youngest reached 10 years of age. The Dominion had no choice but to agree. 2 heirs were born, a female and a male, 2 years apart. They were raised together as brother and sister, and their mother doted on them both. They had the best education. They shared the greatest tutors, yet their curriculums differed drastically. The older, female child was raised to be the future empress, while her younger brother was to become the sovereign.
When they were 12 and 10, they were torn apart with the expectation that they would never see each other again outside of the rare state function.
Wow.
Years passed. The female child became the empress and eventually gave birth to an heir. Her daughter died when she was 15, assassinated by a separatist faction. A decade later, she tried again. Her son lived into his 30s, insisted on personally leading a fleet into war, and died doing so.
Oh, I didn't know. Caldania's public file never mentioned family. Her face was devoid of all expression. She looked like a mannequin.
Her brother became the sovereign and lost 3 heirs. When his 4th heir was in adolescence, the sovereign and his wife had 2 more children, conceived in the natural way, a boy and a girl. The heir was judged to be old enough to be permitted unlimited access to his siblings.
What about his aunt? Did the heir ever see her?
4 times. First, she visited secretly when he was born. He doesn't remember that visit, for obvious reasons, but he was told about it. The second time was when he was 3 and very sick. She sat by his bed, held his hand, and swore to murder everyone in the room if he didn't survive. The third was when he was 12. She had come for the 10-year summit between the Dominion and the Supremacy, and late at night she met him for 5 minutes under heavy guard to tell him that she was proud of him and his accomplishments.
Caldania gazed at the pond as if she had gone deaf. What about the last time?
It was years later. The Dominion faced civil unrest. In theory, everyone agrees that the realm must evolve or die. In practice, people resist change because it threatens their way of life. They have the luxury of not worrying about the future of the nation. They care only about their survival in the here and now. Not everyone supported the Sovereign's reforms, no matter how much they were needed. A plot was hatched to kill him, and he was infected with a biological agent that resurrected the dormant genetic disease. It was never fully eradicated. It had just been suppressed.
Caldania crossed her arms on her chest and stopped by a bench facing the water. Her nephew stopped next to her. They stood 5 feet apart, not looking at each other. This was all so sad and terrible.
The Sovereign knew he was dying. If the true cause of his death was discovered, as it would be, the fitness of his heir would be called into question. The genetic weakness of the previous generation was too well documented. The Dominion, which already faced an external threat from a foreign power and was experiencing a civil crisis, would fracture even further. The heir was still very young, half a year from adulthood. He lacked the power base sufficient to avoid a civil war.
They would have killed him. They would have murdered the heir and the other 2 children. And then they would have clawed their way to the throne over their bodies.
The Sovereign had to die in a way that would hide all signs of the disease. Someone had to kill him and take credit for it. The Sovereign couldn't be murdered by a random nobody, because that would make the dynasty look weak. He couldn't be killed by someone from within the Dominion, because that would make his entire faction look incompetent in failing to detect this threat and endanger his son's ascension.
I didn't like where this was going. Cassandian stared at the pond.
The assassin had to be someone powerful. Someone frightening. Someone with the means and the motive who could make this murder so loud, so outrageous, that the entire Dominion would unite in sympathy behind the heir. Instead of a weakling who failed to anticipate and resist a threat, the late Sovereign had to become a martyr. His name a battle cry.
The hair on the back of my neck stood up.
The Sovereign asked his sister for help for the very last time. And she came.
Of course I came. He was my baby brother. In the end, family is all we have.
The fourth time my aunt visited me, I watched her poison my father. Resvan had brought me to witness it. I stood in a hidden passage and watched it so that later on I could stand before the Dominion and name my aunt as his killer with honesty and sincerity. The Dominion would feel my anguish and my sorrow and know that they were true.
I am so sorry.
Keep your pity. I knew the consequences.
I had never seen Caldania so fragile. She'd given up her throne and plunged 2 nations into conflict to save her brother's children. Tony, Resvan, and the 2 visitors crossed the inn and were coming down the path toward us. Cassandian smiled, a bitter parting of lips.
It cost my aunt everything. She had been feared before, but now she was reviled and despised. Her decades of careful governance had been forgotten. The Supremacy, shocked by the outpouring of collective grief from the Dominion, turned against her. She fought to hold on to power, but eventually she abandoned that struggle and fled.
Caldania gave him a long look, and the fragility evaporated.
And yet, I'm alive and doing quite well. The entire galaxy has been trying to separate me from my head for years, yet here I am, what is the saying, dear? Living my best life.
Cassandian finally turned his head and looked at her.
I am glad you are well.
She looked back at him.
No need to get all solemn about it, my dear. Don't forget, I have seen you in swaddling clothes. Not only am I doing well, but you still seem to require my aid.
Cassandian bowed.
Thank you, Vasuakar.
Oh, it was a small thing. Don't bend your head. You are the sovereign.
And you will always be the empress.
The empress of what? I left those fools with a strong nation that functioned like a well-oiled machine. In less than a decade, they managed to fracture it into three puny kingdoms, one of which came to you begging to be taken in.
In fairness, they brought us wonderful mineral wealth.
I don't mind that you helped yourself. Galaxy knows somebody should have saved them from themselves. But I don't understand why you left the other two unattended. You should convince them to join you, my dear, by whatever means are necessary. Frame it as a rescue of the Dominion's dear brothers and sisters. It would help your image and give the military something to do before they get antsy and start dreaming up a coup. Nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Two kids came down the path and stopped. A girl around 15 or so, and a boy a couple of years younger. Caldania saw them and fell silent.
They know. Would you like to say hello, Aunt?
Yes.
Cassandian offered her his arm and led the Empress to meet her niece and nephew. I stayed where I was, giving them the privacy they needed. Nobody was in danger here.